Anybody have any questions? You have a camp up here, there's a lot of us up here this time, it's not just me and Lucky. Maitreya. From last Sunday's satsang, please explain again why the ahankara seems to cover the being so completely when it so clearly does not seem to cover other objects, trees, etc.
Okay.
The sukshma sharira means the subtle body. Pervades the physical body right through the sense of touch and through the sense organs. This is a little technical, but I'll make it better as we go along. Okay. There's a identification with the body, okay? Because of the subtle body, which has the mind and the sense organs, all of which are sattva. Sattva reflects consciousness, as though it reflects consciousness. So through your sense of touch, the subtle body pervades the whole physical body. And so with the sense of touch, that gives consciousness to the physical body. Like say, for example, to the whole physical body. So say, for example, if you were a paraplegic, from the place of wherever the spinal cord break was, everything below that, chances are you would have no sensation at all. And so if you closed your eyes, your sense of the body would only go to that point. See what I mean? The mind also being sattva, any thought reflects consciousness. So the body reflects consciousness because of the sense of touch, the sense organs pervading the body through the sukshma sharira. And the mind being sattva, it enjoys consciousness. Sattva means it reflects consciousness. And so the ahankara, the I notion, is not going to identify with something that doesn't reflect in one way, doesn't reflect the consciousness through the sattva. So in other words, for instance, my sense of touch pervades my body, but it doesn't pervade the space around me. And it doesn't pervade the chair that I'm touching, right? I feel the chair, but it doesn't pervade the chair for me to have an I notion that takes myself to be the chair. You see? It only pervades the body. Your mind, because your mind is sattva, reflecting consciousness, every thought that you have as though enjoys consciousness. That's why we have to do this viveka, the discrimination, to see, well, in fact, conscious being is never moving. The thoughts are continually moving and coming and going, but they're coming and going in consciousness, which itself is never moving. So I have to see that. Otherwise, the mind just thinks I'm the conscious being because every thought it has enjoys consciousness. So why shouldn't it think that? Now I have to differentiate between consciousness and the thoughts, because a thought comes into being and goes out of being. Next comes into being and goes out of being. I don't come into being and go out of being. Being doesn't come into being and go out of being. Conscious being just remains. The me just remains, right? So now I have to have a viveka for that. Unless I have that viveka, the ahankara, which means the I thought, is really just another thought, and it also enjoys the same ignorance. It's just a thought that takes itself to be me, right? But it's not going to, and then the ahankara takes, it means it's going to identify the body with me, or the emotion with me, or the thought with me, or all these things that actually come and go in my experience, it identifies as me. Because when it's there, it's fully enjoying me. Because I'm always there. I'm the very being which these thoughts that come and go enjoy when they're there. So why shouldn't they think I'm me? Because they are me, just like the pot is the clay. It's true. What isn't true is that if I make the pot into a plate, the clay remains and the pot is completely gone. Because it has no being apart from the clay. Nothing happens to the clay, the clayness of the clay. Because all that's really there is clay. So all that's really here is me. These things are coming and going in me. Like, but they have no independent being, and that's the viveka. That's what I have to. That's what I have to recognize. So the problem here is that, say you look, you say, like, from how the ahankara seems to cover the being so completely. The ahankara is not covering the being. It's identifying being from the standpoint of the mitya, from the standpoint of the mind and the sense organs, the body. It's identifying that body with me. It's identifying the mind with me. It's identifying sense perception with me, because these things never don't enjoy me, right? But they come and go and I remain. That's the thing. So, but then it says, but being so completely, when it so clearly does not seem to cover other objects, trees, etc. Well, that's because that subtle body doesn't go over to the trees for the trees to say, I am me, right? It doesn't do that. It's, unless you're psychotic. If you're psychotic, that actually does happen, you know. But if you're not psychotic, you don't have that problem.
Well, could you see it, say the tree is me then?
Well, that's what I'm getting to.
Oh, okay.
So you see, for a jnani, you're not, you've already have the, for one who has self-knowledge, you already have that discrimination between me and the perceptions that come and go. Right. So that viveka, that discrimination is there. Then you recognize that in fact, in any thought, any experience that you have, enjoys me. Right? I am the very being, the consciousness, which every experience enjoys. Enjoys means is pervaded by me. And so now with that, if I don't have the identification that this me stops at the body, then I recognize when I see the fire exists in me. The fire is 10 feet from the body, or 12 feet from my body, but it's not 12 feet from my consciousness. It's not 12 feet from my being, it's 12 feet from my body. But this fire, the fire is as much in me as the wall is, as the space is, as this is, as this is. Because the whole thought itself is not away from me. Like, just to make that clear, if I ask you right now to imagine a meadow that has grass and trees and animals and friends, and you just imagine that meadow. Well, when you imagine, and you are walking with your friends in the meadow, okay? So you know you have this imagination. Now, the entire imagination, including you and all of your friends and all of the grass and the sun and the space, everything, the entire meadow imagination exists in you. We don't have any problem with that. We don't say, oh no, it's only my body in that imagination that enjoys me. You know that's not true, because the whole imagination is yours, right? But so no problem, yes, the whole thing exists in me. Now, if you can see here, like in this room, that your body and mind and sense organs are objectified, they're known to you, and they exist in this room. Just like all of you exist in this room, this body exists in this room too. Although I can see all of your sense organs exist in this room. They're part, right? Because here you are sitting there, I see your sense organs. But I have my sense organs too, and they're also here. So now just imagine, instead of thinking of this as a perception, where I'm me and you're all you, think of this as your imagination. This is your imagination. I'm just pretending, but just think, this is your imagination. Now, if you think that, or what if I ask you to close your eyes and think of this room as your imagination? See? Then you don't have that identification with the body. That's so strong, that's the ahankara. Instead, you see the whole thing existing in your being, in your consciousness. Now you come back to this room that you're seeing through your sense organs, and see if you can recognize that this me is not contained. Conscious being is not contained. The me is not contained. This whole room and everyone in it exists in me. But the ahankara is so strong that it takes this me to belong to the body, mind, sense organs. Remember, the ahankara, the I notion itself, is just a thought, which I illumine. It also isn't any reality. It's just a thought. Like, say if I say, this is a couch, and I have a little sign, couch, right? Or chair. This is a chair, okay? Does a chair need this little reminder, chair, you know? It doesn't need it. It doesn't do anything for the chair. The word I doesn't do anything for me. It's not like the I or the word me is adding anything to me at all. It's a label. But if the label is aham, I am Brahman, I am the Atma, I am the Self, and it's correctly labeling me, that will vastly change my relationship to with the world, but it, as opposed to it being ahankara. Ahankara means it's an I notion. The I lands on me, the true self, the clay of the pot, but then takes this me to belong to this body. The body and the mind are superimposed on, the body and the self are superimposed on each other. So I take this sense of me that's very personal me to be this body. That's the ahankara. But I don't have a subtle body or a sense of touch that pervades the entire room so that I have a sense of feel the whole room like I feel this body. So the ahankara doesn't go out there. Yeah. So what has to happen with knowledge is that the ahankara becomes, instead of this notional I, it becomes I, and the I lands on who I actually am, and the body is the body, and the mind is the mind, and the thoughts are the thoughts, and the emotions are the emotions, and I am me. If they're not superimposed on each other. When that's the case, then there's a stable self. You know yourself.
I can see all these thoughts coming and going. But the I thought, the notion that I am my body, that doesn't seem to come and go. It's a different quality thought than the other thoughts that just zoom around.
Well, it's a different quality thought because, and it's the same with your mind, right? Because these are always, because you have a subtle body pervading this body, that's going to be different than your relationship with the chair. You don't have your relationship with a computer. Because the subtle body, or this five sense organs in mind, don't pervade that far. You know, for me to have a sense of I there. Whereas if you're a jnani, if you have self-knowledge, this very strong sense of identification, there's no separation between my body and me. It's just one entity, like a red hot iron ball. When I don't know fire and I don't know iron separately, it's one thing.
Yeah.
Right? So that's your situation here. It's just one thing because that discrimination has never been made. Mm-hmm. And so many of all the teaching methodologies that we use in Vedanta are different ways of unfolding your experience to you so that you can recognize the changeless amidst the changing, right? There's not much you can say once you have, if say we're just talking about experience, there's experiences that are coming and going and there is one that is not, only one. All of the others come into that and go out of that. And that one that is not changing is not an objectifiable experience. It's not like I can objectify myself and I am looking at myself, because then you would be the one looking, not the one, right? Mm-hmm. And so the my own me is self-evident and not an object to be objectified. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's where the I has to end up landing on the one who's always present.
But unless you do this discrimination, the I thought, the I notion of mistaking myself, that won't come and go. That stays.
You know, the thing to remember is that whether you have knowledge or you don't have self-knowledge or you don't have self-knowledge. Either way, the ahankara is labeling Brahman, yourself, the truth of yourself. It's not landing anywhere else. So when it says, when you say, I am, perfect, that part is good. But then you say, I am upset. Okay. Now you're dressing yourself with an emotion that comes and goes. Or I am this body, or I am 12, or I am 20, or I am 30. You know, or I am a man, or I am a woman. You're identifying this me that is you with all of these experiences that come and go. But you're correct in identifying you. That's true. It's just you recognize that this you is actually free and is the you of the whole universe, in fact. Mm-hmm. That the very me that is me, this very me that is me, this personal me that is me, is you. There's only one personal me. It's not a universal me. I don't want to be a universal me. I want to be me. But what about when you recognize that the me that is me is the self of that yourself, this personal self, is the self of the whole creation? That yourself is really the very self that we call Ishwara. You know? Which means that your mind is always with what we say, in English we say is God, or, you know, that ultimate simplicity of being, or whatever words, different things. Let me get this, Edward. You're breaking into the question here. Yikes. Well, it's just trying to continue. So Maitreya says, So the most subtle sensations of touch, thought, feeling, body, mind, sense organs, which contribute to the misidentification, need to be discriminated as mithya. Yes, but let me say a little something about that. Discriminated as mithya can only be done when the satyam is recognized. So let me, just for some people in the room here, just reiterate what satyam and mithya is. If you have the clay pot example, what is actually there is clay. The pot has no being apart from the clay. So that's what we mean by mithya. It's there, it's to be experienced. We don't deny the experience of it, but it has no being apart. It's totally dependent for its being on something else, which is the clay. So that anything that enjoys that condition is called mithya. The truth of what is there is satyam, what is actually there. And what is actually there, upon analysis, itself can't be something that comes and goes. Mm. Then it's bordered by non-existence, then it also is mithya. So in the end, what is satyam, what is absolutely true or real, is being itself. And being can't come from non-being. So being itself is timeless. The being that you are, the amness, the truth of your experience is non-dual, timeless being, which is me, which is you, which is your very self. So you are always correctly labeling that, because mithya, whatever is mithya, anything that comes and goes, has no being apart, has no being. Because it comes into being and goes out of being. It's bordered by non-existence. So all of your experiences enjoy being, but the being that they enjoy is not something that comes into being and goes out of being. And that's what you're continually, the mithya, mind, is continually labeling you correctly. The mind says, you know, I am a conscious being. Which it is. It's just the conscious being, which is me, which it is timeless. I am timeless. I don't come and go. The mind comes and goes. The experiences comes and goes. So, yes, all of these experiences that can take on the I thought, the ahankara, those are called upadis. And upadi, the body is an upadi because the I can land on it. I am the body. The mind is an upadhi. Upadhi is sometimes translated as conditioning agent. So the mind is a conditioning agent, because I can say, I am my mind. Or I can say, I am my thoughts. Or I am my feelings. Or I am happy. I am sad. I am smart. I am stupid. I am tired. These are all conditioning adjuncts that can take on the eye. So they're called upadhis. So they have to be recognized as such, but nothing can be recognized as mithya, you know, without the satyam, without knowing what is actually there. Otherwise, mithya is the reality and you're making up some content. You have to recognize what actually is the satyam, the truth of the mithya, in order to label something as mithya. So that's a little important, just a little subtle thing that you have to... So here, Jagadish, it is interesting that the ahankara does identify with the hair, fingernails, etc. when they are attached to the body, but when those parts are cut off from the body, they are considered as not me. So the viveka and the inquiry has to be very strong. It has to be very, very strong, because the identification is so strong. We take it so for granted, you know. And so actually you have to do this type of viveka from many, many different angles. Many different illustrations, many going at it from many different angles to appreciate it, to appreciate the freedom of your own being in different ways. Oh, so, hang on a minute. Do we all have our devices turned off? So this one's not. Oh, you got it, Maitreya? Good, I'm glad. You're clear on what we were talking about, I hope. When you talk about we take experiences as ourselves, can you talk a little more about that? Like, when I drive to the store, am I taking that experience of the drive to be myself? Because I don't feel or recognize that I do. No. That's kind of, David, when we're talking about the subtle body being identified with the physical body, when you say, I'm going to drive to the store, you don't take yourself to be the car or the driving or anything like that. You take yourself to be this body, mind, sense organs person called David or called Jackie or called me, to be the self that is driving to the store. In other words, there's not a differentiated self from the body, mind, sense organs experience. That's what we call this anyonya adhyasa in Sanskrit. It means mutual superimposition, where the sense of me, which is correct, that is Brahman, there is no other self. But from the standpoint of your mind, there's no differentiation between your mind and yourself, and between the mind and the body, actually, because the mind, the subtle body, is indwelling the physical body. And so the five sense organs, sense of touch, goes all the way through the physical body. You know, and so you just take yourself to be one unit. So you don't experience the drive as yourself, but you experience yourself as the driver. See what I mean? Because of your identification with the body, mind, sense organs. As the doer and enjoyer. Yeah, you take yourself to be the doer and the enjoyer. Karta bhokta, exactly. That's right.
Could you run that by me one more time? What are you supposed to think when you drive to the store?
No, David was just asking how far you take yourself. You take yourself to be the one. Not that you're not. You don't take yourself to be the drive to the store. You take yourself to be the one who is driving to the store because of your identification with the body, mind, sense organs. So this is me, and I am driving to the store.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the self's not driving anywhere. There's only one self, right? And you're not moving at all. Say if you're walking, say you're taking a walk, and then you think that you're carrying yourself along in your body. right? As you walk, you're carrying yourself along. That's actually not true. That's like saying, say if I, they use the example, like say if I have like a pot and I'm holding the pot here, little pot in space, and I move from this point A, I move the pot over to point B. So now have I taken the space along with me? See, am I carrying the space along with me? Is there a pot space? That now I say there's pot space, but what about here? What happens? Have I kind of ripped the space? Is that, am I leaving a hole here? Right? But no, I'm not leaving a hole, because the space isn't moving at all. The pot is moving through space. Space is more subtle. So that's just an example, like when your body is moving, is the self, who's not objectifiable within time and space, moving? Say no. Now think of it like this. Say you have the imagination of the meadow and you have friends in the meadow and you're walking along. Is the self moving? The whole imagination comes from you. The time and space belongs to the imagination, right? If you imagine a meadow with people in it, the time, the space, the sun and the sky, and the, you know, the trees and the meadow and the animals and all of your friends, all this activity is taking place within the time and space of the meadow imagination. What about me? The self of the entire imagination, the one who gives the conscious being to the imagination. Am I walking through the imagination? I'm not walking at all. Right? I'm not an object within time and space. I'm the one in whom the time and space takes place, more subtle even than space.
So do we view Ishvara in those terms, that this is actually his imagination? Is it identical?
Well, it's not identical in the sense that Ishvara isn't a little man in heaven having an imagination.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think of conscious being, your own being, with this capacity to imagine, mm-hmm, on an infinite level.
Mm.
So that there's this capacity, just conscious being, plus what we call Maya. So you, all individuals, enjoy your little bit of Maya, right? Because you can imagine, you can project a snake on a rope. It's an incredible power, actually. So you enjoy a little bit of it. But now think of that Maya in terms of infinite Maya. Like an infinite expression of absolute knowledge. Why say knowledge, absolute knowledge, or a limitless expression of knowledge? I don't have quite the right word there. Anyway, limitless expression of knowledge. For you, like say, if I ask you to imagine a tree, I say the word tree, but this is like when I was talking Nididhyasana, about Nididhyasana this morning. But say you say tree, tree's there. Right? Not a physical tree, but on a subtle level. You think tree, image of tree. You think pot, image of pot. You think sun, image of sun. Anything you have knowledge of. So you say the word in the nama rupa. Nama is the knowledge, rupa is the image or the form. You know, so the whole creation, so for you, your mind is always a manifestation of the knowledge that you have.
Which is finite.
Yeah, it's limited. But when you have limitless Maya, that's what we call Ishvara. It's the same self, but now limitless knowledge, of which you are a part. And just think, you have limited knowledge, but it's a limited knowledge of a meadow with people walking through. Those people are a part of your meadow. So you're the Ishvara of your meadow imagination, right? You're the lord of your meadow imagination. And all everything within the meadow imagination is part of your world,
mm-hmm,
of your story.
Mm-hmm.
So now look at this universe as an infinite manifestation of knowledge. That means that all of these images can be in manifest form or in unmanifest form. Like, for instance, I asked you to think of a tree, you thought of a tree, and I don't think you're thinking of tree a tree again until I just brought it up. Mm-hmm. You still have tree knowledge, but it's not manifest. So they look at the universe as an infinite, a manifestation of infinite knowledge. It comes into manifestation and resolves, and into manifestation and resolves cyclically from beginningless time. And all of the contents of that imagination belong to the imagination. We don't call it imagination, we call it the jagat, the universe.
Srishti.
Srishti.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's the vision of the Upanishads.
That's far out.
You mentioned knowing the order of reality. What specifically do you mean by orders of reality? Satyam, Mithya. Orders of reality, I mean Satyam, Mithya, and Tucham. Satyam means it's an order of reality. It means that which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. Means it is as it is. It is not limited by past, present, or future. It is, period. Can never be negated. That's satyam. There's nothing in the creation that enjoys that order of reality, because everything in the creation is coming into being and going out of being. Mithya is that which depends. It has a dependent being, because mithya, anything that's given that order of reality, means that thing comes into being and goes out of being. So it has no being of its own, because if it comes, it's born and it dies, it's bordered by non-existence. Nothing can come out of non-existence. Literally, non-existence means it's not there. So nothing can come from that, so it must depend on something else for its being. That's mithya. So the pot is mithya, the clay is satyam, in terms of the limited framework of that example. Because clay also is mithya, but in reference to the pot, it's satyam. Tucham means that order of reality is one that we just use to differentiate it from satyam. It means absolute non-existence. It is not there. Tucham, it's not there. There's nothing you can say about it. It's not there. Never was there, never will be there. It is not there. That's what we call tucham. We even use this word tucham in order to help define mithya. Because mithya's, in a sense, not really there. Like if you say the clay pot, the pot's not really there, because the only thing that's there is clay. But then it's useful, and we experience it. So this whole creation is useful, we experience it, but it has no independent being. Just like the pot is there, we experience it, we use it, but it has no independent being. Dependent totally on clay. The only thing that's really there is clay. So here, in terms of this whole vast, infinite creation, this display that we experience, and it has so much, says science and math and order, you know. But upon analysis, it is mithya, because it depends upon being itself as a noun for its existence. It has no independent existence, and being itself is the truth of it all. And that being is you. Because it's the truth of you also. Right? And what is the truth of you? The one you can't get rid of. The one that doesn't come and go. And so when we're kind of analyzing our experience, we come to recognize everything objectifiable can come and go. I can't. I can't touch myself. I can't sully myself, I can't change myself, I simply am. And that amness, that conscious being, needs to be recognized. You recognize it totally. Like if you say, I am the body, you're referring to that being, not to any other being. But you're so used to only thinking of it in terms of your body or in terms of your mind, you know. You don't think about you in terms of yourself. You think about you in terms of something you're actually objectifying through your sense organs, or that you have a subject-object relationship with. Never think of yourself from your own standpoint.
Is there any slipperiness to always equating amness with beingness? Is there anything about amness that's at all?
What's good to go from amness to beingness is almost third person. Yeah. Amness is first person.
Yeah.
And so the beingness being itself is labeled as amnes in terms of me, but it's exactly the same thing. You can't objectify amnes, but you can't objectify beingness either.
So there's no danger in using amnes as a...
No, in fact, I think that you should be using them back and forth. Yeah. That's what you have to do, because the being has to fall upon your own amnes. That's why Swamiji will sometimes say, maybe it's better to just say, I am, the rug am, you am, the window
am.
Well,
that makes it real personal.
Yeah, the thing is that it is personal. You cannot objectify existence. You can only be it.
Oh.
Yeah. Let me see this. Laura, with the psychotic, the I-thought is projected onto perceptions. With the garden variety, neurotic, the I-thought falls on the subtle body. And with the jnani, the being sense pervades all of Ishvara. You mentioned Jagat, J-A, it should be J-A-G-A-T, Jagat. Or I can review what you just said to Edward. Let's see. Let me read that again. With the psychotic, the I thought is projected onto perceptions. I think that's right, yeah. With the garden variety neurotic, the I thought falls on the subtle body.
Garden variety neurotic.
We're all garden variety. I've used that term before. That's a term psychologists know. Most of us are garden variety neurotics.
All of you are.
Or some of us have personality disorders, but most of us are garden variety neurotics. So the I thought, yeah, subtle body lands on that. And then that's identified with the physical body, of course. Then the jnani, the being sense, pervades all of Ishvara. Well, because your mind doesn't pervade all of Ishvara, you have to say that the being or the sense of self, the me, we know that it is not objectifiable and so is not an object in the world, and also that all experiences have that for its being because it's satyam. And so in terms of your limited experience to the mind, this body, you recognize that the totality of your experience is enjoying you, because your mind, your sense of I is not so contained in the body by that ahankara, that I notion. Now I recognize myself is that I'm not really contained. That's the way it is anyway. You do recognize it or you don't recognize it. The mind doesn't recognize it because it's so just focused on itself being the self, you know. But once that stops, you recognize, just like you recognize if I ask you to think of the meadow, yourself isn't contained in of the body, it's contained in the whole experience of the meadow. The whole meadow exists in me, not just my body, in your imagination, right? So now say you have that knowledge clearly, now here you are in this room. We're all together in this room. Now you can, not only does the body, mind, sense organs enjoy you, you're able to recognize all that your being is all of this is your being, because you're not contained. From the standpoint of the body, you're contained. From the standpoint of the mind, you're contained, but you are not contained. And so if you're looking at this room through your sense organs, this very room that we're in, you're looking through your sense organs, and now you just do a gentle shift to your own being. You have a viveka now, discrimination between you and the room. Okay? Then you recognize yourself as not contained, that the whole room is in you. But I'm not talking about some woo-woo thing.
Yeah, know? That's abstract.
No, I'm not talking. I'm not trying to be magical here. Then you're going away from what I'm saying. It's already that way. You have to just notice it.
Mm.
And that's not woo-woo. You know, it's like a magical experience.
Because Timothy Leary would talk that way.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Maitreya, thanks. Do you get it now? That's good. So Jackie says, so mitya is name and form, nothing more, nothing less. That's it. Is that correct? Yeah. That's correct. That's right. The thing is that that name and form breaks down into smaller names and forms into smaller names and forms into smaller names and forms, so you think there's really something there. But in the end, the only thing that is there is Brahman plus Nama Rupa, name and form. That's right. So, Lara. So even psychotic thoughts have not lost contact with the self, but lost contact with the small self. I think with psychotic thoughts, nothing loses contact with the self. They just don't know that. They don't know that, but the truth of that whatever is going on is only the self. But what happens in psychosis is that...
What is psychosis?
What happens in psychosis and a psychotic thought is that the ego, instead of being identified with the body who is experiencing this world, gets lost. You get lost in your imagination. The self gets lost in the imagination. And the imagination actually can even get projected onto the whole room. You know. So yeah, I think the language way you're saying it is probably exactly what it is. From a psychologist's point of view. It's like the ego gets lost, the ahankara, everything just gets screwed up. Jagadish, the one thing that we cannot deny is that we exist, so the sat and chit is easy to comprehend. The ananda, fullness, wholeness, completeness, and oneness is not so easy to comprehend. Why is that? Well, okay, let's take it one by one. Sat is existence. I know that I exist, right? But I also do, I know I exist now. I don't know that I might exist tomorrow. In other words, I know I exist, but I don't know that my existence is timeless. Okay. But still, the existence that I exist, I know. Same thing. I know I am a conscious being, and you are a conscious being, you are a conscious being. I don't know I'll be a conscious being when I die. So even though the sat and chit seems to be a continuous recognition, it's still totally superimposed upon my mind body, right? And so it becomes something that's bound by time. The chit, so that's consciousness and existence. So there's in Vedanta, sometimes the Atma is called Sat Chit Ananda. You are being, existence, you are consciousness, and you are Ananda. Now the thing is, Ananda is often translated as bliss, instead of the experience of fullness coming from the ananta, limitlessness of my being. And so we are actually looking for a bliss experience. We're not looking, searching for, or being guided to the recognition of my own nature, which I'm either using the word ananda to point to, or wholeness, or fullness. I try to find some words that act as a pointer to differentiate my, to just point to the nature of my being, which you're the one who has to define. But say if I say, well, just notice that wholeness or completeness or fullness, that puts you in the right direction. But what if I say, you know, look at the shameful, hurtful, ugly nature of your being, that puts you in the wrong direction, you know? And so there's another thing. Also, when your mind is happy, because happy is a state that comes and goes. You're feeling happy, you feel compassionate, you feel blissful. You like those states. Mm-hmm. Because it's true that they're like reflections of you. They're not you because they come and go, mm-hmm. right? And they're also changing. Like I can be happier, but I could be more happy, or I could just be peaceful. But all of them are fine, you know, on this positive spectrum. because they're all resonate with your with you. They're not the same because they come and go, but they resonate with you. And so I can use these words like ananda, fullness, wholeness, completeness, oneness, that's all, as pointers to your inner, to your the recognition of, like when I we did in the meditation today, I said, what are you really like? What is your being like? Not your body, not your mind, what are you like? You know? And then then you can even, a good question is say, why do they call me Ananda? Why do they say I'm Ananda or fullness? What's full about me? And we mean the me that is here right now. What? Why do they say that?
Yeah.
And then that has to dawn on you, kind of like a bing, like a light going off. Well, because there's nothing more dear to me than me. Why? What is so dear? And then you start paying attention to yourself and you realize the tremendous beauty. So simple. It's not big lights flashing off of like a bliss ball or something that's come out of the sky. It's not that. But it's something so beautiful, so subtle, and so naturally me, but I've never really noticed. And then you notice that there is really nothing more dear. And then you say, ah, that's why they call, say, Ananda. So the perceived universe is names and forms of Brahman. That's right. Brahman is the content. The only thing you have to realize is that those names and forms are mithya. You see what I mean? If you don't say they're names and forms of Brahman, but the names and forms are mithya, which means they have no being whatsoever of their own. Like if you say if you take the clay pot example, all of the names and forms of the clay are nothing but clay. So here, all of the names and forms of the universe are nothing but Brahman. Brahman is what is actually there. So you have to remember mithya. Jackie and David, positive experiences resonate with you, but negative ones don't. Yeah, they don't. Because they are, they're painful. They're things that you want to push away, to get away from, you know, that you want to change, you want to transform. The positive experiences, the reason they're positive, well, why do we call something positive and something negative? Because the positive ones I feel at home with. I feel like myself. They accentuate my being. The negative ones are like foreign invaders. They're like I need antibodies to fight them off. You know, I don't take them to be myself. I take them to be hurting myself. How about in here? Does anybody have anything?
Can you say something about sometimes people identify with what they own, for example?
I think that's true. They even talk about that in the Vedanta. So
they don't talk about
they
that?
They do, I said. They do. So Andrew says, sometimes people identify with what they own? You know where they especially use that example is with your children.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
That's the very strongest example where, you know, Even the I notion goes out, even to you feel that so strongly, that identification, that your whole life, your whole well-being, everything, you know, is dependent on the behavior of your child. You can also be very identified with wealth, because your whole self-esteem, who you are, what makes you a worthwhile person, has only to do with your wealth, or with your wealth or power, or with your children. These are the main three points of serious identification. Because your sense of self-worth and everything about you is tied to these things that you think make you worthwhile, basically, you know. And then with children, it's not just about being worthwhile, it's your whole sense of self is existing in your child. That's a big one.
What was that again?
Your whole sense of self is existing in your child, because they are you. You gave birth to them, they're your child. You know, so that's an incredible identification. That's, does that make sense, or do you want more?
Yeah,
that's what it is, yeah. Every experience can only happen in Brahman, so wouldn't both positive and negative experiences be manifestations of Brahman? Yeah, but again, it's the word positive and negative, you know. We would just say if you're a jnani, you would say, yes, all experiences are manifestations of Brahman. All of experiences are maya. Even, we just did a meditation the other day. We were talking about the subjective experiences, jiva srishti, are as much Ishwara as objective experiences. It's just that the subjective experiences are located in an individual body-mind sense organs. But the body, the mind, the sense organs are all Ishwara. The laws that govern the body-mind sense organs are all Ishwara. The things that the body-mind sense organs are capable of experiencing are all Ishwara and all within Ishwara's laws. So in fact, the whole gamut of positive, negative experiences, all experiences, you know, all subjective experiences, all objective experiences are only Ishwara. But within Ishwara, we can divide our experiences to subjective and objective. And subjective means that they're coming out of an individual, not shared, like emotions, for instance, or daydreams, or dreams, or imaginations, or projections. Those are subjective, they're not shared. Objective are the things that are shared. It means we can all agree, or it's a shared reality. So the objective reality, we say, is Ishwara. The subjective reality is the jiva, right? Jiva srishti, jiva's creation. But that doesn't mean that the jiva's creation is independent of Ishwara, because the jiva can only create within the order of Ishwara.
So the jiva's projections are considered Ishwara's because the laws allow for that, but that misidentity?
Well, just like what I said, listen to this. The body is Ishwara, this body, right? It's objective, it's shared reality.
Sure.
Okay, so the body, the fact that you have a mind, that you have a memory, that you have sense organs, that you have prana, this is all part of having a body, right? So that's all Ishwara.
Mm-hmm.
Now, also the laws that govern the body and the mind and the sense organs, and those laws are all Ishwara. That's why in psychology, we can understand what another person is feeling, what they're going through. These are the garden variety neurotics, these are the personality disorders, etc. We understand all of that because it's a shared reality, the equipment, right? Now, the thing is, this equipment is capable of producing experiences within the realm of the laws of the creation.
Okay.
Okay? Ishwara. So even though some experiences originating out of the equipment of the jiva, of the individual, that we call
jiva, ignorance,
that we call jiva srishti, right? Those are, they're coming, whether it's ignorance or knowledge, it doesn't matter, they're still coming out of the jiva. There's nothing about the jiva that is not contained within Ishwara. All of the laws and everything.
Okay.
You see?
Yeah.
So that's why you can...
That doesn't give you much relief, though, I mean, if you're doing a subjective projection.
No, but I'm just answering this question.
Okay.
Yeah. You're laying different questions on the question I'm
answering.
Sorry. Yeah, just be quiet.
All night?
No, I'm kidding. For people who lose their I thought in others, like their children or reputation or lover, they can remember that it's mitya, but still powerful because it resonates with non-separation. Well, to remember that it's mitya, they have to recognize the satyam, right? You can't have mitya without satyam. That doesn't... There isn't any... Nothing becomes mitya without recognizing what is satyam. That's an important thing. For people who lose their I thought in others, like their children, or reputation or lover, they can remember that it's mitya, but still powerful because it resonates with non-separation. Because it, yeah, I guess, I don't know. I don't quite understand your question, Laura, I kind of do, but they can remember that it's mitya. I would say like this, say you have knowledge to know that something's mitya, but you're still behaving that it's not like it's not. Right, that's because of what we call habitual ignorance. Habitual behavior that was based in ignorance. You get rid of the ignorance, but the habitual behavior keeps on. The emotion, call it emotional lag time. Yeah, it's compelling to see oneself in the outer world behave like you don't know anything, even though you do. But then you start to understand that's all part of it also. You have to give yourself time. Give the emotional lag time. It's not Shaktipat, you know. There's a complex system that you're dealing with here, of your psyche and unconscious and conscious, all that. Anybody in the room? Any of us? Have anything? Okay, one more question. I don't see the difference between saying everything is names and forms of Brahman and needing also to say that they are mitya, non-separate from Brahman. Seems like both statements are saying the same thing. This would be the difference, David. They can be saying the same thing if you're taking it that way, but somebody can think everything is names and forms of Brahman, and then you see Brahman is becoming all names and forms, changing into different names and forms, you know? Rather than if you say mitya, non-separate from Brahman, Brahman is not changing. Like the relationship between, say, you and your imagination, between consciousness and the imagination doesn't change the consciousness, even though it totally depends upon conscious being. For itself, the conscious being undergoes no modification whatsoever to become the changing names and forms. So that's why this mitya is so important. Isn't Brahman expressing itself as the names and forms? If you can say that, but as long as you don't think Brahman is doing any kind of expressing, like any kind of modification, it's just a natural expression of Brahman that is mitya, means that Brahman doesn't go through any modification whatsoever to become those names and forms. That's what we mean by maya. If that's not clear, we have to have a kind of a longer discussion about it, maybe in class on Thursday in satsang. I'm not ready for it now. Yeah, we can get clearer on it. We just need to spend a little bit more time. It's a very important question. So, okay, everybody, I think I'm going to call it a night now because some of our people are leaving tonight. Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha gopramanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samastha sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parajanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yam kshobha rahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhak bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritangamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Harihi Om. Om.